Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG this afternoon. Instead of JFG tonight, we have changed our time today so we could speak with Edward Dutton. He's been a past guest of the show, and it's always enjoyable to talk to him. How are you doing, Edward?
Hello. Hi. How are you doing? Yes, it's been quite a while. I remember when we last spoke in the afternoon. It must have been years ago now. So, yes, I hope all's been going well. Oh, I know it hasn't been going well up your way because you've got a maniac in charge of the country that you live in. So there's no way I can say, I hope things have been going well. That would just be taking
Justin Trudeau.
Things have been going badly up your way. I'm very sorry to hear it, but hopefully he'll be washed away with the tides
well, at some point. When you're a Canadian, you are used to being ruled by this kind of guy, so it's not like it's going to ruin your life. I've totally accepted that I would be ruled by communists for the rest of my life.
Oh, well, okay, yeah. Yeah, communists that like blacking up. Yeah, that's people with who are transracial communists, and you have to just live with it. So absolutely. Yes, what's been going on?
Yeah, well, the reason we couldn't speak that much is that I didn't take much guest anymore because I was stuck on YouTube and the freedom of speech there is totally reduced and I didn't want to get in trouble. But Odyssey has risen as a platform, so now I'm streaming on Odyssey and I enjoy my life here. We have a much more freedom of speech. We can't say anything, but it's much more open. So I'm glad to be able to speak with you because these old censorship issues, they break friendships, basically. It's like we couldn't speak that much and we couldn't really interact on the subjects that are interesting just because a bunch of people have taken over the internet.
No, indeed. I recall saying to you, do you want to talk about my Islam book? And you were like, no way. We're not discussing that. I'm not stupid. I don't want to lose my channel. So, I'm very pleased about Odyssey as well. I have to say, I'm an Odyssey as well. And they actually contacted me, the chap in charge, and said, I'm glad to hear you're on here. And it's smooth to use, and it doesn't got the nutters that some alternative sites have. And I'm very pleased with it. It's potentially the way forward. Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. We have two things I wanted to discuss. First, you have a new book out, Sent Before Their Time, Genius, Charisma, and Being Born Prematurely. So the societal role and evolutionary impact of being born preterm, and especially as it relates to genius. And then I wanted to talk to you about the concept of spiteful mutants, because Richard Spencer told us you have a work that's currently brewing on spiteful mutants, and I have disagreements with the term. We can talk about it at the end. For people who are joining us, you can send the super chats and questions to me and Edward on Odyssey. Just use the support button, or you can use the Entropy link and send super chats through Entropy. Do you know someone who is born preterm? That is our survey question tonight. I personally know no one who's born preterm. It's not something that's very present in my family. But you were saying, you were writing in the book that you were born preterm.
I was born 3 months early in 1980. And back then, the survival rate of people that were born that early was about 25%. I calculated through various data that I found what the survival rate was of people that were born preterm into adulthood historically. It wasn't as low as you'd think, because, of course, only the best genes were there was less dysgenics essentially in the past. You know, people were genetically healthier. There wasn't a buildup of dysgenics, but it was still very, very, very low. And so you might expect something like 2% or something like that of the adult population to be born preterm. What I showed in the book is, well, firstly, that geniuses, accepted scientific and artistic geniuses based on convergent bibliography and the research by Charles Murray into human accomplishment and so on, people born preterm are overrepresented among geniuses, about scientific and artistic and whatever geniuses. And secondly, it's very noticeable. I mean, I can't talk about the statistics of it, but they are huge among charismatic figures and mythological figures, that you have all of these pre-termers. Moses was supposedly born 3 months early. Buddha was supposedly born 3 months early. Muhammad was supposedly born over a month early. There's some people that have argued that there's evidence that Jesus was born pre-term. I'm not so sure about that. But there are various other churches Churchill was born 2 months early. Savitri Devi was born 2 months early. Madame Blavatsky was born 2 months early. There are many, many, many examples of it. And so I thought, well, that's interesting, isn't it? Isn't that strange? Because you would expect being born early is the biggest single predictor of bad life outcomes. People that are born early have lower IQ. They have psychopathic personality. They have autism. They have ADHD. They have all kinds of problems. They have lower income than the controls, and they lower education level, and they just do worse. So I thought to myself, isn't it interesting that the geniuses that they're overrepresented among geniuses? And it struck me as a little bit like what you find with left-handed people. So on average, and by the way, people that are born preterm are massively left-handed. Left-handed people are lower in IQ than right-handed people, but people that have outlier high IQ are more likely to be left-handed. And if you look at geniuses, people that do well in, let's say, academia, they tend to have high intelligence combined with highly pro-social personality, high agreeableness, high conscientiousness, low neuroticism, whatever. But the people that are geniuses, the research on that indicates that's not what's going on. Geniuses have outlier high IQ plus basically moderately psychopathic personality. And that's been found again and again. So it struck me that to the extent that all people that are born early are overrepresented among genius, it is likely that is causal, that the environmental insult of being born early has, in their case, gone just right, such that they have, because first of all, people that are born prematurely are more likely to have skewed intelligence. So geniuses tend to have outlier high intelligence, but it's skewed. So you might get that they're brilliant at maths, but they're tongue-tied and can't express themselves or something like that. It's skewed. And because of the brain damage that is done when you're born early, because of the skull being thin, because of the lack of oxygen, all this stuff, the brain, parts of it have just destroyed. And so it has to co-opt other parts of the brain to make up for it. And so you end up with funny relationships in the brain. And one of the things that you get is skewed intelligence. The most extreme example of that is what used to be called idiot savants or autistic savants, people like Rain Man. And these people are overwhelmingly born prematurely, and they tend to have brilliant intelligence in one very narrow area. A good example is someone called Derek Parvicini. He's retarded, he's blind, which is another thing that correlates being born prematurely, going blind. But he has a piece, perfect pitch, and he's an amazing musician. So that's the first thing they have in common with geniuses, this skewed intelligence. The second thing is that scientific geniuses tend to be high in autism. And it's this that means they don't care about offending people, so they generate brilliant ideas, and they're truth focused and whatever. And that is a correlate of being born prematurely, autism. The third thing is ADHD. ADHD means you can incredibly focus on certain narrow things for very large periods of time, though you get bored easily of other things. And this is high among geniuses. This is high among people born prematurely. And the final thing is just psychopathic personality, which means that your aspects of it, which means that you're more creative. It means that you think outside the box. You're not rule bound. You don't mind offending people. This is found elevated among geniuses and among people that are born prematurely. So my argument is that these various amazing genius preemies, Isaac Newton, Kepler, both born about 2 or 3 months early, and there's many others, it would have been causal, because it would have been the narrow yet high intelligence plus the psychology of the preemie would have helped to create genius. So that's the essential argument.
There are lots of bad outcomes for premature babies, and you are describing some exceptional good outcomes. Is it possible that we're talking about a kind of enlargement of the bell curve, basically, where risk and uncertainty and chaos in the development of the body and the brain would lead to more extreme outcomes?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, that's one thing that I guess I articulate in a slightly different way, but that's one of the things that I look at in the book, actually, which is that it could be good for the group to have this variance, to have this possibility of variance. such that you can get these geniuses, these group selected sort of people. So an example of that is if you have a larger than gene pool than you need to, the downside of that is the variance that causes very bad outcomes. Criminals, psychopaths, murderers, dilettantes, that sort of thing, you know, dreamers and spongers. But then that can be outweighed by the good outcome of that, which can be high IQ geniuses that do brilliant things for the group. There'd have to be a mechanism for that to happen. And one mechanism was genetic diversity. Another mechanism could be neurological diversity. What could be the causes of that? Well, one mechanism is women, old women having children, such that it's not healthy for them to have children when they're 50, but let's say they have children when they're 50, and this results in weird outcomes, you know, normally bad, but it opens the possibility for a positive outcome. And it's the same with perhaps an optimum level of prematurity.
You say autistic savants are overrepresented in the premature category. What kind of percentage are we talking about? What's the chance of being premature if I'm an autistic savant?
I don't have the data to hand, but I'll have to look it up. But I just know that quite a lot of them are known to be born prematurely. And so, for example, Derek Parvicini was born 3.5 months prematurely. But it's just a known relationship. I'm not aware. I'll have to look it up.
Okay. So there's a mechanism in the brain that we discover when we see someone, for example, who's had an amputation.
And 50%.
50% of the autistic savants are born prematurely. Because you were describing how they will have specified intelligence in a certain domain, and then the rest, they may actually be lower than the rest of the population. And I was thinking there's a mechanism in the brain where if you have amputation, for example, the part of your brain that controls your left arm and you lost your left arm, it will eventually dedicate itself to other tasks. And for example, people who are blind, their visual cortex will eventually dedicate themselves to other tasks and will start responding to auditory stimuli, for example. Is it possible that this is a mechanism that would lead to that kind of genius where certain pathways not having the time to develop, the brain says, fuck it, I'm going to dedicate everything to what I have left. And perhaps what they have left then is mathematical calculation or retaining a certain number of decimals of pi or whatever it is that they're fascinated in.
Yeah, I think that's a very good idea. And I think that's perfectly possible. In fact, there was a study which I cite in the book by, I think it was a Norwegian researcher called Olsen. And he looked at the way in which people that are born prematurely respond to information. New information, and he looked at the way that people, that controls responded to it, and it was shown that the people that are born prematurely, and it was very prematurely, 2 months or more, and of course they've got parts of the brain that are damaged, and they would have had the same mechanism that you suggest, which is that the brain works differently. They respond to new things, they respond to information even if it's not new, as though it's new. And that's obviously very interesting in terms of understanding being excited by things, being fascinated by things, but also being worried by things and concerned about things and anxious about things. And there was research by, at the University of London, Adam Perkins, that showed that one of the things that might explain the correlation between neuroticism, which is elevated as well, by the way, among premature people, they tend to be high in depression and anxiety, and that tends to correlate with artistic genius, is that you're constantly thinking, you're constantly worrying, and thus you generate new ideas via that mechanism. So there is this sense in which their brains are skewed differently. Literally different parts of the brain light up to solve the same problem when compared to controls. So it would be entirely consistent with what you're suggesting, yes.
Do we know of any factor that can cause the preterm birth?
Yes, a big one is the mother having high blood pressure or some kind of shock to the mother. So, for example, Thomas Hobbes was born about 2 months early in 1588. And he wrote in his autobiography that this happened because his mother heard the news that Spain was going to invade. And she was so frightened by this that she went into labor and gave birth to him 2 months early. It's that kind of thing. So it's a shock to the mother of some kind will cause a miscarriage. And that's what a preemie is. A preemie is basically a very late miscarriage. And that will be more likely if the mother has high blood pressure, for example, if there are various problems with the mother. But it's a shock to the mother, and high blood pressure is the big thing.
Because in modern time, high blood pressure is a thing because of bad calorie intakes and bad diet. It's an overall societal phenomenon. But I'm thinking back in our evolutionary history, you would have high blood pressure if you're nervous. You would have and you probably wouldn't have too much calories intake 1,000 years ago. And so I'm thinking, perhaps there were evolutionary reactions that led it not to be an accident to have a preterm birth, but rather an evolutionary decision. Basically, the mother's body saying, I will be confronted to so much stress. It's not the right time to educate a child then. So it's better to have it now, even if that involves high risk of death.
Yes, possibly. It's perfectly possible. It's certainly known that among fast life history strategy type individuals and among fast life history strategy races, babies are born earlier. So among black people, for example, babies are born earlier than among white people. And among white people, babies are born earlier than among East Asians. So the whole reaction to life is that you've got to get on with it. You've got to get on with it. So it's perfectly, because you could die at any moment. It's unstable. And so certainly that could be built into that. That could be a part of the reason. Yes. But then, and if you have then something dramatic and violent happening, then it's like, well, I could die before I managed to give birth. And so I'd better give birth now. So that could be what the as you say, I think that could be relevant. Yes. But what is very interesting, if you look at the mythologies as well, so it's not just, we've got all this data now on the kind of things that are associated with being born preterm, the different psychological problems, sexual problems. They're more likely to be gay. They're more likely to have sexual perversions. They're more likely never to have children. And they're more likely to have a whole list of physical problems. But it's very interesting that this was observed long ago in mythology and in Shakespeare plays. You get the certain kind of person that seems to be premature, and he's either an evil genius like Edmund from King Lear, the Machiavellian evil genius type, or he's completely mad and insane like Caliban from The Tempest, or he's the flawed positive genius like Murdo, Macbeth, or someone like that. But there's a certain type which they seem to be in mythology as well, which is very, very interesting, I think.
All right. Sorry, you can't hear me. No, I was about to say there is a parallel to be made with the ecology of larval decisions, because some animals are confronted with a seasonal decision to decide whether they become an adult this season or wait a supplementary season. So they basically have a choice on, will I stay a larva 6 months or will I stay a larva 1 year? And it has to be a kind of cyclic decision. They only have one time in the year where they can decide this. And it relates to stores of food. It relates to the shock of the environment that they can receive. It relates to the instability of the ecology. And perhaps you could see a premature birth as being a decision of the mother, that there are risks of not having enough food 6 months from now. Therefore, I have to have the baby now. It's the only way. Then you would expect all sorts of psychological and perhaps epigenetic attachment to this, which would make the baby kind of more of a risk-seeking, perhaps more of a food-storing behavior, because he would be stressed from the possibility that he may lack food or that there may be a military invasion or whatever is the circumstance. Yeah. So do we see other features than what you mentioned, which seems to revolve around the psychiatry of geniuses, but do we see something like increased risky decision-making or increased food intake?
Yeah, they are high. Yeah, I'm not aware of increased food intake, but there is evidence that people who are born, get the book here. There is evidence that people that are born prematurely are more risk-taking. They are, on the one hand, they are averse to change. They hate change. So they see because there's the autism, you have these extremes among them. It's very interesting. So you have these. So on the one hand, the evidence indicates that, yeah, they are very, very averse to change and they're autistic. They hate change. They like order and structure, and they approach the world as a frightening place, and they hate change. But then among them, there is a subsection that are extremely, extremely reckless. In the same way that overall you find they're bad at sport, they're rubbish at sport. Of course, they're bad at sport. They've got mobility problems. They have problems learning to walk. They whatever. But then you get a subsection among them that are fantastic at sport. Wilma Rudolph, for example, who is a famous black runner, champion runner. She was born about 2 months prematurely. And there's a number of other sports people that were Tyson Fury, the boxer. I mean, that's another thing. So on average, they're shorter than people that are born at term because it's an environmental insult, and so they can't reach their phenotypic maximum height. But one of the things that can happen as a consequence of being born early is something goes wrong with the development of the pituitary gland, and then you end up being massively tall like Tyson Fury, who's 6'10" or whatever he is. So you get these weird contradictions, these extremes among premature people. And yes, you get both, the parents will comment that they're both reckless on the one hand and hating change on the other. You get the same thing within these people, I guess, because if you've got the mixture of autism and psychopathology, one militating in favor of risk-taking and one militating in favor of avoiding risk.
Mm-hmm. Carlotta sends a super chat. He says, Ed, somebody was born very prematurely in my family. Age 2, she had the best verbal ability I've ever seen. Absolutely incredible grammar. Later in life, she was completely normal. Does it make sense?
Yeah, it does, because you do tend to have this skewed intelligence. And one of the things that you find with people that are born prematurely is that they will the damage seems to go to the mathematical ability and to spatial intelligence particularly. So they tend to have very poor spatial intelligence. They tend to have very poor mathematical ability. And so I suppose that that part of the brain is more likely to be damaged. I don't know. And so therefore, this is redirected towards verbal ability, and that they will have this skew whereby their verbal ability will be incredibly high. So it does make sense. Another thing that you get is they develop later, because if you think that the brain is damaged, and so it takes the brain longer to slowly fix itself and find ways round these various problems that have been imposed upon it. So the correlation between IQ aged 8 and IQ aged 18, I think it's something like 0.6. But it's much lower among people that are born prematurely. It's about 0.2 because they will develop late. And so they might be quite average at 12, and then suddenly at 14, 15, maybe then something will flip. And you also get this with geniuses, a lot of geniuses. The Francis Crick is an example. Einstein is an example. Newton is an example. They develop late. And there's something to do with autism. I guess there's a brain damage involved with autism. They are late developers. It's very interesting. They often don't shine at school or even at university. They shine later. And that's also, I guess, consistent with autism. Autistic people have a weak sense of self. And so it takes them longer to kind of work out who they are, what they want to do. And if you have ADHD, it takes you time to realize what fascinates you and what you should have been working on all along. But no, it's not. And anyway, sorry, go back to the question. No, it's as you would predict. High verbal intelligence among preemies.
I also think that success in school is so social in nature. I mean, being a successful scientist, a professor right now in the university is basically developing a social network. And it has very little to do in the end with major discoveries or creative endeavor.
Well, yeah, I think you're right about that. And that's increasingly the case.
Yeah.
But if we go back to that sort of window, that period of time where the group-oriented religion was collapsing down and the individualist-oriented religion, as I like to call it, hadn't completely risen up yet, that golden period, I don't know, between 1870 and 1970, maybe, I don't know what the period was, then the universities were much more focused on just basically finding these high IQ autistics and getting them in. And even in that context, someone like Francis Crick, who's a Nobel Prize winner, was rejected from his first choice university and got a mediocre degree. Someone like Einstein was rejected from the university he wanted to go to and had to go and get a job as a postal clerk, and so on. So even in that context, the universities underserve geniuses. But now, of course, yeah, it's particularly extreme.
Deadbeat Chess has a super chat. He says, could left-handedness be a safety mechanism existing only to counter the emergence of a threat that relies on a right-handed target? So I think, if I understand correctly, his hypothesis is invoking the possibility that we would be left-handed just to fuck up basically the opponents, to mix them up with something they've never seen, so that we're able to counter certain threats to our mostly right-handed society.
Yes, there is there's two things worth saying there. One is that left-handedness correlates with testosterone, and men are more likely to be left-handed than women, and fast life history strategy type races are more likely to be left-handed than slow life history strategy races. Level of left-handedness is about 12% in Europe. It's about 4% in East Asia. And among the Yanomamo, the fierce people of Venezuela, it's about 25%. So the left-handedness is a response to it's developmental instability, i.e. an unstable, unpredictable ecology produces people that are adapted to violence and instability, and that is they are left-handed. So therefore, you could argue, yeah, it's in a broadly right-handed society, which we brought, it's a way of dealing with threat, because testosterone and violence and whatever in general are a way of dealing with threat. So I think that's how one could answer that.
Interesting. And now we move on to the evolutionary theme of the premature birth book, Sent Before Their Time, by Edward Dutton. I will put the link in the description for those who want to get it from Amazon. So you're stating that there may be evolutionary consequences at premature birth that may affect not only the individual, but the whole of society in terms of a group strategy?
Well, potentially. If you accept the idea that you can pass on your genes at an individual level, fine, we all accept that. But let's go from that to kin level. Can you accept? Yes, we can pass on our genes indirectly by a kin selection. There's no essentialist border between kin and non-kin. And we know that even primitive societies have massacres of other ethnic groups and whatever. So it seems very, very likely that we can talk about there being such a thing as group selection. And I defended it in detail in that book. Now, one method of group selection would be to have geniuses that come up with brilliant ideas. So an optimum level of genetic diversity and an optimum level of instability, if you like, of developmental instability, such that these geniuses could be produced. And so there could be some benefit to having an optimum level, a lot of geniuses caused by prematurity. And so that could be one means via which a propensity for this to happen could stay in the population. And that's what I speculate on in the book. So it could be that because you've got all these geniuses, they're disproportionately premature. And so that could be the mechanism via which it happens. And then you get the people that are the scientific geniuses that are premature, the Newtons, the Keplers, whatever. You get the people that are literary geniuses, the Victor Hugos, whatever. You know, he was born about 3 months early, Victor Hugo. Quasimodo, his character was meant to be premature as well. So those kinds of people that inspire the group and so on. So yeah, that would be my idea.
But then with beta, I mean, there's a way I can see this work. The way I would think of it is we're kind of farming geniuses. If we think of the geniuses as a cow, basically we would have evolved to drag their milk, which is their knowledge or creativity. However, I'm not aware of any societal mechanism that could be described as kind of not intentional, but evolutionarily directed causing of preterm birth. Are there societies that are formed to cause more of this?
No. I think it wouldn't be in that way. But you'd have to end up with an optimum level of genetic diversity, such that you had enough women that had, I don't know, blood pressure problems or something like that. So enough a level of illness, really, things that are negative, that are in itself negative, but they stay in the population because of a positive result. In the same way that psychopathology can be seen to stay in the population, possibly, because it can lead to some positives. And one of the reasons why you don't get much in the way of genius in Northeast Asia is because they just don't have enough psychopaths. Because the flip side of psychopathology is the criminal that balls the society up, and they can't, they're so up against it in evolutionary terms that they can't tolerate that. So therefore, you don't get the positive side. Whereas we in the West are perhaps in a kind of Goldilocks zone where we can tolerate the negative side to some extent. So therefore, we get the positive side, which is the genius.
Very interesting. Indeed, the Asian societies have basically gotten rid of insubordination, probably by being authoritarian, law-abiding. And so we have, I don't see as much insubordination in the creativity of even a equal intelligence or higher intelligence Asian. You will not see them go against the grain or contest the current scientific standard.
the Japanese have a level of per capita major innovation, or if we use science Nobel Prizes as a proxy, which is at the same level as Romania. And Romania has an IQ of about 85. So it's that even though the Japanese IQ is about 107. So you can see that there's something beyond IQ that's relevant to this. And I did a paper with my Japanese colleague, Ken Yakura. And as far as it's something he just calls curiosity, and there's certain alleles, he argues, that seem to be associated with it. And these are the prevalence of these is just very, very, very low to nil in East Asia, in Europe high, in Finland intermediate between the two.
Now, that's a very that we agree, and the facts are there. The description of it, I agree. The one place where I may differ from you is I'm not sure it's a group evolutionary strategy when we consider that high of that broad of a societal system. Isn't there just a just-so story here that certain societies converge, that essentially the products in the domain of creativity are accidental products of much more genetic-oriented mechanism for evolution? For instance, these societies may not have taken that path because they didn't need the genius or because they made kind of an evolutionary trade-off, but it may be at the individual level of the evolution of individuals that they were favored for not being psychopath for some reason that was advantageous to them, and it's not for a service to society that they're that way.
Well, if that were so, there's two points I'd make about that. First of all, we have substantial evidence, even from primitive societies, of whole-scale massacres of other ethnic groups. And so once you get that, then that is group selection. That is group selection in action. So therefore, there is group selection. Secondly, the individuals, on average, who are geniuses tend not to pass on their genes. So whatever they tend not to have children themselves. And that's also true, by the way, of preemies. And so it's an evolutionary dead end to be a genius. It's not whatever genius is, it's not being passed on directly via geniuses having children for that reason. And secondly, because even if they do have children like Charles Darwin, the unlikely combinations that produce them are so unlikely that they don't breed true in the children. So they just, but so no, so I think that precisely because they are, or in general, an infertile caste, what would make more parsimonious sense of it all would be that we're dealing with some sort of group selected phenomenon.
And group selection, I didn't even intend to get there, but this is something we've addressed before, but I don't think we got to the middle of our perhaps disagreement on there. What is group selection? Do you call group selection merely the fact that certain groups are selected and they benefit from increased existence, if you will, as opposed to other groups who disappear from existence? Or do you think of group selection as a separate mechanism from natural selection?
No, I don't think. I think that it's important in science to be what Karl Popper called cautiously essentialist. So you can't be too essentialist and draw black and white lines and just, you know, whatever, but you can't have no essentialism at all, otherwise you can't make predictions. And so there is no hard and fast line between kin, as in kin selection, which almost any biologist would accept is real, and at some point, kin has a grey area. Oh, is your third cousin your kin? Oh, not sure. And then it merges into group, into what we like call ethnic group. And again, there's no hard and fast line between ethnic group and race. And in certain contexts, not all, there's no clear line between species, because the certain species can interbreed, but that's more contentious. But certainly within humanity, you can there is a line continuously from self up to the level of the whole of humanity, and you can talk about group selection as humans selecting in their interests against other animals, so to control more resources and survive better than other animals with whom they are competing. So I see we were recently in a case of group selection with COVID-19, kind of, sort of. So I think that you, I think it's perfectly reasonable to talk about group selection. It's just, if you can think about kin selection, let's, you know, what call it super kin selection, extended kin selection. All that is lost is a word. If group selection is associated with, I don't know, early sociobiology, and therefore we don't like it because we don't like early sociobiology because it made lots of mistakes. But I think it seems, I can't see any reasonable argument against it based on the evidence at hand.
One of the issue I take is that, okay, let's agree with the basic mathematical case here. Race, let's call it race selection or species level selection, wouldn't be that different from kin selection. However, we don't automatically say because you are kin, you share evolutionary interests that will play out as an evolutionary force in your existence. In other words, it's not just the fact that you share genes with your brothers that will lead to behavior that are altruistic toward your brother or that are kind of favoring toward your brother. There needs to be an evolutionary environment in which this contrast can show. And I have no issue believing it for the brother, for the cousin, because there is 100 ways in which I can imagine our evolutionary past where we would distinguish between my brother and someone I don't know at all from another village. That's easy for my brain to distinguish, and it's easy for me to imagine the tribal differences that we're developing through merely the fact that kids raised together know that they belong to the same genetic group. I'm not sure that we have that much of a case for a repeated racial distinction in between people. In other words, I'm not sure that my French ancestors were meeting African and Asian people and developing some kind of a European consciousness around it.
If you look at the, I mean, it's a very interesting paper that was published in, what was it, the name of the social science journal, Nations and Nationalism, I think the name of the journal was, by J. Philippe Rushton, in which he brings together all of the evidence for genetic similarity theory. And it's been shown that even among siblings, the relatedness is not exactly 50%. And even among large numbers of siblings, the people get on better with the sibling to whom they are more related. So it's that fine-grained. Parents will get on better with the child to whom, on average, to whom they are more related. People will get on, and then among friends are more related than could be the case by chance. Couples, again, you're engaged in inclusive fitness, are more related than could be the case by chance, and so on. So all of that implies this mechanism is extremely fine and that we are hyper aware and of genetic difference and genetic similarity. And so therefore it doesn't necessarily require the social, and it could extend beyond that. Also, there are studies that have shown that when you are shown a picture of a person of your own race who is a stranger, you react very differently from being shown a picture of a person of a different race who is a stranger. When you're shown a person of a different race who is a stranger, you become unconsciously on edge. It stimulates the most primal parts of you, which it doesn't if they're of your own race. So this would be consistent with the idea that we are evolved to be attracted to genetic sameness and be repelled by genetic difference. And the more different, the more repelled we are. In prehistory, the extent to which we came into contact with other races was limited. And there are, by the way, always periods in the rise and fall of civilizations in which races do come into contact.
Yes, and there are also people who specialized across generations to be merchants, to be trading between nations. And I would have no doubt that they evolve eventually to distinguish between perhaps having differential behavior toward different races. I mean, if I'm Jewish and I'm traveling between India and Western Europe to carry whatever spice or whatever I'm selling, and perhaps there is a behavior to be had in India that is optimal and a behavior that is optimal to have in Western Europe. that being said, the things you mentioned are evidence of compatibility. And behavioral compatibility is a thing, but it doesn't prove that historically there has been enough occasions for this behavioral compatibility to matter evolutionarily.
What I'm saying in the least violent way that I can is that it doesn't matter. Let's forget this race thing. That's this example of essentialism again that is the problem. Forget it. It's just distance from self. We are evolved to react positively to things that are genetically similar to us and negatively to things that are genetically dissimilar from us. And it doesn't mean you don't need race to have become involved in the history of humanity to be able to do that. You will just react to the first time you see an Aborigine or whatever in the 1770. You'll just unconsciously think to yourself, bloody hell, he's very different from me. It doesn't matter that the race border is not needed. It's just extent of difference. Now, of course, there's a social dimension to this. I mean, we can, you know, Jean-Marie Le Pen, the French far-right leader, said that, look, my world is a world of concentric circles. I'm at the center of it. I like my family more than me more than I like my family. I like my family more than I like my kin. I like my kin more than I like my nation, and so on. But you get cases of things imbricating that. I mean, I would be more upset, you know, if my dog died than if my cousin died. Because even though my dog is genetically much more different, I mean, we have a common ancestor, 80 million years ago? But he lives with me and I've bonded with him and whatever. So that you get these things that cut across it, of course. But on average, it's genetic similarity, which is predicting it in a series of sort of concentric circles, really. You don't need to have these hard and fast borders between kin and group, or indeed between group and race or whatever. That's the point I'm making.
I think we've laid out each of our beliefs on this, so people will be able to judge. But I would like to say one thing. You mentioned that we shouldn't care about the race level, because in the end, we will respond to racial differences. The thing is, I agree, we will respond to racial differences, whether we have evolved for it or not. But I care. I care about knowing, is my reaction to a different race accidental, or is it a product of a continued evolutionary system that has played out in the last 100,000 years? To me, that's different. It's different whether our kin reactions are pre-programmed into us by a natural selection process, or whether they are accidental products
of something else. I suppose so. I mean, you can imagine a situation where you have two ethnic groups and they're separated by mountains and whatever, and they don't have much to do with each other. But very occasionally, during, I don't know, cold periods or whatever, they venture into each other's lands. And then they fight, and then it gets warm and they go back again like that. That something like that could have happened at the border zones of races. And so you're right that if something like that did happen, then you might get some sort of selection for, perhaps we could call it, racial consciousness.
Because that is the only threshold at which I say, okay, then maybe there's something like selection happening toward behaviors that are nationalistic or headed toward the group.
Oh, no. But you don't need to go that far with that, though. No, nationalistic is, that's ethnic groups. They are much less separated. We absolutely know that they have come into contact continuously throughout history. That's a different thing from race. Well, the races are more separated.
I mean,
which races as well. So you could talk about the Europeans have long crossed over at the borders with the North Africans, for example. Although there's a sea and there's various other separations, but then other, you know, the Native Americans and the whites, not so much. I'm not supposed to have the full answer, but I think you don't. The point is that you don't need it to explain reaction to difference and what different races. It's the extent of difference. People will tend, if you look at mixed race marriages, they tend to be to the extent that they occur between races that are quite similar. So, for example, a mixed race marriage is far more likely in America between whites and Hispanics. What are Hispanics? They're about half white and half East Asian, basically, than between whites and blacks. Now, that would make sense in terms of genetic similarity.
All right. Shrigma Mail has a super chat. He says, my fiancé says twins are born prematurely. She asks, why is this the case? I think it's a matter of energy consumption and the fact that the space is consumed more by twins than by a single baby, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, but also the twins are therefore inherently born prematurely, which might help to make sense of all of the twins you have in mythology and interesting twins, because they would have some of the same psychological problems as singleton premies.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Moving on to the concept of spiteful mutant, because Richard Spencer was on this show and he was telling me that this will be the title of a new book.
That's right. I have a new book coming out in the next few months called Spiteful
Next
Mutant.
Few months. All right. And are you the sole author, or is it in collaboration with Richard Spencer?
It's his publishers that's publishing it. Oh, okay. I'm the sole author.
Wonderful. So what is, can you define the concept of spiteful mutants? What is the role of the word spiteful with relation to mutant and mutations?
Well, the idea is that until 1800 or whatever, we were under very, very harsh levels of Darwinian selection, 50% child mortality and so on. And so anybody that wasn't very, very, very fit was expunged from the population. What we were selecting for at that time was intelligence, was group orientation, was religiousness, was whatever, this bundle of things. With the collapse of selection, you then get a buildup of mutation. You get people that more and more people carry more and more mutations. And because the brain is about 84% of the genome, it's a particularly large target for mutation. And so you're going to get some people that simply have views which due to genetics or a genetic environmental interaction will foster views which are damaging to the interests of the group, to the interests of the group of which they are part, to pass on its genes. Basically extreme individualists. Those people, we will call, from the perspective of the group and the group's interests, apropos other groups, can be seen as mutants, their higher mutational load, and spiteful mutants. And so they will direct the society in a way which is not conducive to that society's fitness. Once you get about, and now I've nuanced this a bit since we last discussed it, and so I think I saw a video where you said with regards to my hypothesis, fuck him and his hypothesis. So I'm hoping that having nuanced it, there will be a bit less fucking today than there otherwise would have been. Okay. Let's put aside the fucking focus on the. The foreplay, the nature of the hypothesis anyway. So you get these. So you, basically, what you're going to get in that we're highly, highly group selected. What, to a great extent, any deviation from that norm will be in the direction of individualism. So what you will get is a buildup of individualistic type people, people that are evolved, I suppose you could say, to a fast life history strategy, people that are selfish, people that are high in Jonathan Haidt's individualizing values of, you know, harm avoidance and equality, rather than in the group oriented values. And then once they reach about 20% of the population, or 20% of the elite anyway, then a tipping point is reached and the society flips over, as I look at in the prematurity book, to being individually oriented. And then you get runaway individualism. But what this is spearheaded by is particularly extreme examples of these kinds of individualistic type people that wouldn't have survived under these harsh Darwinian selection pressures that we had in 1800. Those people will be high mutational load of the mind, so they'll propose highly individualistic ideas, which are bad for, perhaps they're good at promoting the fitness of other individualistic people. So in that sense, they're good for their fitness, but they're bad for the fitness of the group. They encourage ultimately the group, people not to have children, people to renounce fertility. What you get now with these extreme woke people, the most extreme manifestations, they call it, what's it called, climate strike, where they're a birth strike, it's called, where these women are not having children, for the good of the environment or whatever. And they're being incited to do that by these particularly vile mutated people like Andrea Dworkin or whatever that tell them that all sex is rape and whatever. So these people can be conceived of as kind of anti-geniuses, as spiteful mutants, the high mutational load, and therefore they are extreme individualists, and therefore they push the society in the group in a fitness reducing direction. So that's that, and then it creates a sort of, I suppose you could call it, a new crucible of evolution. The crucible of evolution was child mortality. If you could get over that, then you'd probably pass on your genes, you'd be all right. The crucible now is wokeism and the ability to be inculcated by wokeism. And it seems that those that avoid being inculcated by wokeism are those that have a strong genetic desire to have children, i.e. the pre-industrial normal remnant population, or just stupid people who don't can't be inculcated with the current ideology, so they have children by accident.
I have to orient myself to fully understand here, because the word selfish is used in a way that I'm not familiar with. As far as I'm concerned, selfishness is a feature of the capitalist system of property. And in fact, to a certain extent, the wokes, I don't consider them selfish. they are mob mentality type of people who collectivize in their own way.
Let's look at that. No, if you look at the data, and I look at it in the prematurity book and also in the Spiteful Mutant book on the psychology of people that are on the extreme left, okay, they are fast life history strategists. They are low in agreeableness, they are low in conscientiousness, they are high in mental instability, and they are therefore high in Machiavellianism, because if you're mentally unstable and you see the world as a dangerous, frightening place where everyone's out to get you, then you will tend to want power and power over them. They are high in narcissism, because narcissism, if you are mentally unstable, a way of coping is by telling yourself that you're brilliant and whatever, and having high self-esteem and thinking that you're great. So these are selfish people. And one of the ways in which you play for status, if you are a person like that, if you are highly Machiavellian but you are mentally unstable and you see yourself as weak, is via virtue signaling, which itself, because that's playing for status, but it's a covert method. It's not putting yourself out there and potentially risking violence. And that's why women tend to virtue signal. So they virtue signal, and virtue signaling itself has been shown to be associated with Machiavellianism and with dark triad traits. So what you're dealing with these people is very selfish people, are very individually oriented people, and therefore they are concerned with harm avoidance and equality, because it's all about them, and they want to get power for them. They're individually oriented, and they are prepared to fuck up the group of which they are a part in pursuit of their own interests. Indeed, there was a study that was published by Waits et al., which found that in terms of what you identify with, if you're conservative, you are high in all five of these moral foundations. So that you're relatively high in equality, in harm avoidance, in sanctity, in group orientation, and in obedience to authority. If you're left wing, you're low in the group oriented ones and high in the individualizing ones, they're definitely selfish people, no matter what they say. But they then can create groups in their own interests, of course, alliances to attain power. And one of the things that they do is they're born traitors. This paper by Waits et al. It showed conservatives identify with kin and ethnic group. That's their locus of identity. Liberals, no, they identify with the other ethnic group. So they identify with something that's not them. And of course, what that allows them to do is to collaborate with others in the interests of their individual status within the group of which they are a part. And that's, of course, what they do. That's what is the coalition of the liberal other than individualistic left-wing white people who treasonously collaborate with foreigners, indeed bring foreigners into the country. They identify with foreigners over their own people. You know, William Wilberforce, who abolished slavery, he was terribly upset about black people being enslaved that he never, ever met. He was terribly upset about this. When it came to white people who committed, he was perfectly happy for them. There's cases that was found just starved to death. He didn't care about them. He had no problem with appalling conditions for white servants. He had no problem with flogging for them. He had no problem with execution for them. But black people, that was a problem. Because he was a born traitor. That's what he was. And so you've got these highly individualistic people. And as I say, these people will be a deviation from what we were originally selected for. They will be basically mutated. And in that sense, they are spiteful mutants. They are spiteful to the group of which they are a part. And they direct it to such that it flips over into individualism. And when it flips over into individualism, then it eventually ends up with an ideology which is fitness reducing and tells people not to have children, and that's the spiteful thing. It's maladaptive, and then it just now you could say, and that's one thing that where my views have changed, that this is inherent in the nature of things, that it's good that this mechanism exists. If it didn't exist, then we would simply go on becoming more and more mutated forever, until you have mutational meltdown and we all die out. But that's never going to happen, because always, if it's like it's just a massive Malthusian cycle. We have this artificial warm period. Lots of mutation builds up. Eventually, the mutation you get extreme cases of this in the group-oriented society. It induces people that are only a bit mutated to not have children, not pass on their genes. All the mutation dies out, and the society collapses. And so therefore, all the people that are mutants are all killed, and we go back to a much smaller population and then we just do it all over again. But you have to have that. You have to have that process, and it always happens. It's just the Malthusian cycle taken to an extreme.
It has to happen, and my disagreement may have seemed semantic at first, but ultimately what you acknowledge is the kind of association with the out-group. And what it leads me to, the way I see what you just presented, is you are arbitrarily choosing a definition of society as being, say, America. And okay, yes, the leftists, by liking the foreigners outside of America, they are teaming up with the foreigners and threatening, through what you call selfishness, their own society. But from the perspective of a leftist, you could say that America is this arbitrary structure that's keeping them captive, and they need to destroy it to make the great association of the global world, either under humanitarian justification or we are all one justification. And in their own way, they are collectivized just at another level than you.
The counter argument to that is that if you actually look at the psychology of them, they are not collectively oriented. They are selfish people. They are low in agreeableness. They are low in conscientiousness. They are not collective, and they are low in the collective moral foundations. So that's the counter argument. That's the argument that demonstrates that when they say they are collectivist, they are lying. They say they want to create this utopia, but there will never be a utopia. It will never be enough because they are Machiavellian people. They will always be competing for status. So even if we did create what they want, I know, a global government of equality, they'd just find something else. They'd collaborate with animals. They collaborate with aliens from outer space. Whatever.
Some of them are already doing it. Now, we only have 5 minutes left because we both have some things to do this afternoon and for you this evening. So I want to get to the heart of the disagreement with the spiteful mutant concept, which is this idea that what you call traitors evolve in groups has always been around. And it's been they call it parasitic, basically. Richard Dawkins would describe this as societies with too much altruism are eventually subject to parasitism. You call it selfishness here, and it's totally fine. It's just a difference of word. But we're talking about the same thing here. We're talking about the fact that in a society that starts giving advantages to the group, this advantage can be drained by traitors who take the advantage, but they don't give back to the solidity of society, and in fact they will have traitor behavior that will eventually threaten the society. Do we really need a spiteful mutant concept when in fact it seems to be the path of natural selection? It seems to be that what's happening is that in a generous enough society, there are natural selection forces that will make you lose your ability to be altruistic, your ability to give to the group so that you can pump more of that energy. And whether that happens through a mutation on gene 1, 2, 3, 4, doesn't matter. In fact, any mutation will do. And these mutations, therefore, to me, are not merely a mutation. They are selected for because they are the optimal behavior to have in a generous enough group.
You could argue that the spiteful mutant is, well, it's kind of selected for in the sense that it's not selected against. But what I'm saying is you have a weakening, you're always going to have sponges off the group, right? This book here, you haven't looked at it, but my book, Witches, Feminism and the Fall of the West. And I've argued that witches are basically proto-feminists. They were the kind of spiteful mutants of their day, which is why they ended up at the bottom of society, because that was the direction of selection in those times. And they would destabilize the society. They'd upset everybody. They were nasty people. They were fast life strategists. They were having sexual fantasies about being shagged by the devil, whatever. And so we burned them or hanged them, and quite right too. And so the point with this is just that the level of spitefulness is more extreme, such that it is literally directing the group to behave in a fitness reducing manner. And it is a correlative of mutation. So I see that the spiteful mutant concept is perfectly reasonable. It's not being a sponger off society. That's not what they're doing. They're not sponging off society. There's a difference between being a sponger off society, a parasite off society, and actively directing the society to destroy itself. That those are two distinct things.
And here
you can be a sponger off society, and you can just keep your head down and shut up, or you can be a sponger off society, as perhaps they are, and you can direct it to screw itself up. And that's what I'm saying that their behavior and indeed their advocacy is doing. So that's the difference.
Well, parasitic forces often end up being destructive, as we see in the case of viruses. The viruses don't want to kill us, but they very often will end up killing us by the mere fact that their drainage of our energy can be at best neutral.
They're being more than parasitic. So people who are on welfare or whatever, they are parasites of society, but they're not direct. That's their niche. And that's a very successful niche, because in Britain, you know, the only group that has above replacement fertility among whites is people that are on long-term welfare recipients with criminal records. So it's actually evolutionarily an extremely successful niche. That's your parasite. That's your sponger, those people. And you get that throughout history, and we have it now. I'm saying that the spiteful mutant is distinct from that, because it is directing a society which will compete with other societies, and wherein the more group-oriented society will tend to dominate. And it is directing that society to be individualistic to the detriment of that society in a certain term. Although you could argue in the long term, it's probably good, because it will lead to a purge of all of the remotely individualistic types within the society as they imbibe the idea that they shouldn't have children. And all you'll be left with is well, as I said, you'll be left with two types of people. You'll be left with the religious conservative types, and you'll be left with the stupid.
And there we end with a word that you use, the fitness of this society. And that's very different from the genetic fitness. And this is a kind of equivocation I disagree with, because societies ultimately are constructs of the collective actions of the genes at play and the individuals at play. And there will always be the continent of North America. The question is, who will rule who will signal to who, and who will control who? And from the perspective of the leftists, they're not really destroying neither themselves nor their neighbors, nor even the concept of the United States of America. They are simply teaming up with a different group to control them.
They are teaming up with a different group to help themselves as individuals attain greater individual status within their group. That's what they're doing. And they are very successful in they are perfectly successful in doing that. But part of what they are doing is also directing their society. What you end up with once you have these Darwinian selection pressures become so weakened is really a kind of Gnosticism. We had it last time there was a warm period. We had it with the collapse of Rome. You have this Gnostic idea that the world is evil and therefore you shouldn't have children. And that's exactly what the Gnostics practiced and advocated. And it's exactly what these people are practicing and advocating. It's just that it's become more extreme now, and it can spread across the world.
All right. Sent before their time, genius, charisma, and being born prematurely. The link will be in the description below if you would like to get the book. Sprocket had a last question. He said, could preterm genius be explained by preterm babies are taken care of way better by parents because they perceive them as need of extreme care? In other words, do the preterm babies get more parental service?
No, the answer, the evidence is that they actually get less. The bond between the mother and the child is weakened, particularly by the child being kept in an incubator and things like this. The children tend to be worse behaved and therefore less closely bonded with the parents. The kind of parents that have preterm children will be more sort of fast life history strategy types anyway, so they won't bond that much with the children. So, no, I don't think so.
All right, and Val has sent a super chat. He says, could also witches be a derogatory term used by Christianity to stomp on the original pagan religions and their ways seen as heretical only from a Christian point of view? Shagging with Satan doesn't seem realistic, and most likely they just wanted to practice their rites.
No, that's not. In English law, not in French law, they tortured people in France, but in England they didn't torture these women, and the jury system was very skeptical of witchcraft. And these women would voluntarily confess things like the devil appeared to me in the form of a black man and had sex with me in my anus for six consecutive nights, things like this. So no, these were, I suggest these were sex. These were rape fantasies, basically. And that's indeed, it correlates with feminist identification, having rape fantasies, because they're far less strategist feminists. They're man-like women adopted to unstable environments where the men pump and dump. And so the women have to be stronger in order to take on some masculine way of doing things in order to survive. So no, I think the witches were, yeah, I mean, they were called as cunning folk. They were often having a sort of magic, a sort of remnant paganism, that is true, which they were practicing. And that was questioning the Christian system, which upheld the patriarchy, which was adaptive in evolutionary terms of group selection. So in that sense, yeah, you're right in that sense, though.
Medieval Pump and Dumping, that's a book title. Edward Dutton, I hope that you've enjoyed the conversation more than my fuck him, which is all I could say about you back then, because I couldn't have you on the show and I couldn't even talk about some of the subjects you cover. I'm happy that we've talked tonight and that we were able to figure out where our differences lie. But I'm very glad that this discussion happened. Thank you for coming.
Fuck you.